This is an I Am Listening exclusive podcast.
Welcome to Dr. Nikki Explains. I'm Dr. Nikki, a GP of 24 years experience, and this is my friend Sarah.
I'm a mum of four with no medical background.
We've decided to do a podcast to explain medical conditions, hopefully in an accessible way. We often have a guest speaker who has experience or expertise.
The podcast is not a substitute for seeing your GP. If you have medical symptoms that are troubling you, please see a doctor.
We've based the podcasts on NICE guidelines, which is the National Institute for Clinical Excellence.
The podcasts do contain graphic descriptions of medical conditions and may not be suitable for a younger audience or those of a sensitive nature.
Thank you for listening. It's just us today.
Yep.
Don't have a special guest. We have our own experience, our own lived experience.
We can do it, Nikki. We can do it.
And we're going to cover blood pressure.
Should we start off with the basics? I mean, what is blood pressure?
Yes. So our listeners might be aware that you're given these two numbers for your blood pressure. There's a higher number and there's a lower number.
I've never really known what it means.
So, well, the higher number is called your systolic blood pressure. Mm. And that is the maximum pressure in the system. And that is actually the pressure when the heart contracts. So you can imagine when the heart muscle contracts, it squeezes blood out forcefully, and that reaches a peak pressure in the system. And so that's the pressure we're measuring, the top pressure that goes around your blood vessels that you can possibly measure. And so the diastolic, or the lower number, is the pressure when the heart completely relaxes. And so that is the lowest pressure in your system. It's a bit like a system of plumbing where you've got a closed system, you've got your radiators, you've got, you know, that's all joined up. And if your boiler was a pump, you can imagine that the pressure that your heart releases when it pumps is transmitted through all the network of your pipes, which is what happens.
Brilliant.
However, if your blood pressure is too high, you can imagine if you're watering your cress seeds and they're quite fragile and frail. And if you stick your water in your hose on full pressure and then it
blocks
a jet of water on your cress seeds, they're not going to do very well. And unfortunately, that's what the problem is. If you have high blood pressure, that squirt of blood is going to damage all the very fine blood vessels. And we find those in the kidney, in your eye, in your heart. So it causes damage, which we can go into in a bit more detail in a minute.
Okay, so you're given these sort of two numbers.
Interestingly, actually, they're equally significant. So if the top number is high, that's significant, because you can imagine that is you squirting your cress seeds with a super high jet of water every beat. And the diastolic, if that's high, that means that the blood pressure in your system is never low enough for things to recover. So either number being high is equally important, and there have been trials looking at that. Obviously, if both numbers are high, that's also important.
So is it okay to measure your blood pressure at home, or should you always go to the doctor?
Yes, so it's completely fine to measure your blood pressure at home. There's some really good available online devices. You can measure it on the wrist, or you can measure it at the upper arm. We tend to measure it at the upper arm, and there's a little bit of evidence showing that might be slightly more accurate. But to be honest, if you have a wrist one, that does definitely give us an idea of how high your blood pressure is. You can always repeat it at the doctor's surgery, but on the whole, people's blood pressures tend to be significantly higher in the surgery because they're anxious and worried about it.
Yeah. So is there a particular time of day you should measure your blood pressure?
It's a really good question, actually, Sarah, because people worry about things like that. We have got a natural diurnal variation in all our bodily functions, actually, because of a hormone called cortisol, which is released and causes blood pressure and all sorts of things to change. So early morning is different to the middle of the day, for example. Mm. So what I tend to say to people is your blood pressure will naturally vary, and it will never be the same. Two readings will probably never be the same. Blood pressure will go up normally in anybody if you go for a run, for example. And that's because you need the blood to get to your calf muscles quickly and efficiently. And so your blood pressure will probably go up when you're running. And equally, blood pressure tends to go down when you're resting and sleeping. So what we tend to ask people for is a range of readings, of home readings. And that's important because if you come to the surgery and you've got something called white coat hypertension, which basically means hypertension means high blood pressure. And white coat just means you've seen a doctor or you're coming to the doctors and that just makes you anxious. And most people have that to a degree and some people have it very badly. And you give us the blood pressure reading from the machine on that day when you're feeling very anxious and we just have one measurement to go on, then you may end up on tablets for something that doesn't reflect normal life. And so we tend to ask people to go home and do some home blood pressure measures and to take them at different times of day, at different when you're doing different things. And we can then average them out and just see what your blood pressure really is over a week or so. You can, if you find you get really bad white coat hypertension, some people will go home. And even at home, just the thought of putting a blood pressure cuff on makes their blood pressure go up. And in those people, we can do something called a 24-hour blood pressure monitoring. You can get that done sometimes through the pharmacy, sometimes through the GP, sometimes through the hospital. And you basically put a cuff on for 24 hours and it takes your blood pressure at 1 hourly intervals. And, you know, I mean, even if you're really anxious at the beginning of that process, it's unlikely that that anxiety level will persist for the whole 24 hours. So we can take an average and that can easily reflect what normal is.
Interesting.
The other thing I meant to say was that if you keep the arm at the level of the heart, they tend to recommend that. That the cuff...
So not higher than your shoulder or...
Sort of at that sort of level. And that the cuff should really cover two-thirds of your upper arm. So if you're quite a big person, you might find that you need a bigger cuff. Otherwise, you might overestimate your blood pressure.
So, Nikki, what is high blood pressure?
So high blood pressure is defined by NICE, which is the National Institute for Clinical Excellence. And they say that it has to be over 140 over 90 in clinic. If it is that, we can take a second or even a third reading and take the lowest of the three readings to define that. Or if at home, it needs to be above 135 over 85. So that would be a home blood pressure average or something called ambulatory blood pressure, which is where you go to the hospital and you have a monitor put on for 24 hours, which we already mentioned. And it takes, in fact, two readings per hour. And so that's the definition according to NICE. But we then go a little bit further and we classify it into basically mild, moderate and severe, or stage one, stage two, stage three. So stage one would be between 140 over 90 to 159 over 99. And if it is that level, we would do subsequent ambulatory blood pressure monitoring. And that would range between 135 over 85 to 149 over 94. So you kind of take five off if it's measured at home. That would be stage one. Stage two would be 160 over 100 or higher, but less than 180 over 120. And any home readings would be five less than that. And stage three or severe high blood pressure would be over 180 or over 120 diastolic. So all those are treated slightly differently. White coat hypertension, which is where people, as we discussed, don't like coming to the doctors, which is completely understandable. We would suspect that if there is quite a discrepancy between the clinic reading and their home readings. And then the other thing I need to mention is if they're very young, we consider an underlying cause for high blood pressure, which is actually unusual. It's probably, of all the people with high blood pressure, probably only 10% have an underlying cause.
Okay, so you've gone to the doctor, you've realised you've got high blood pressure. Mm. What can be done? Or two questions, really. What can be done and what would happen if you didn't treat it?
I mean, I think that's a really big question because people tend to feel completely normal with high blood pressure. If they've got the very severe, stage three high blood pressure, which is relatively unusual, they can feel headachy, muzzy headed and just not quite right. It's a bit vague, but they can feel a little bit unwell. But on the whole, people feel normal. The other thing about severe high blood pressure is you might have the effects of high blood pressure causing symptoms. But on the whole, people are generally symptom-free. And the problem is that if you leave that, it's the analogy of the cress seeds again, if you leave that pressure, it doesn't damage the body straight away. It does take several years, really, because you're fairly resistant. Just like if you were watering your cress seeds to begin with, the cress would probably come back to life. It would, it wouldn't over and die.
Yeah.
And so in the same way, your blood vessels and your end organs that are being pummeled by this high blood pressure, they can put up with that for a bit. But what we've discovered is that if you leave that for 5 to 10 years, then you start to get damage, and it damages things like your kidneys, your heart. It can damage the back of your eyes and affect your vision. And so
there's this permanent damage.
It's permanent damage. Yeah, so that's true. The other thing that happens is the body tries to repair. So if you have a lot of high pressure blood going through your arteries, it can pummel the walls of the arteries, and it can slightly nick the walls of the arteries. So they're lined by some cells. It's a very sort of specialist area. They're lined by things called endothelial cells. If you pummel that with high pressure blood and you've damaged the endothelial cells, the body tries to repair that with something called a plaque, which is a calcification. It's basically a piece of hard tissue that develops to try and protect the wall of the artery. But the problem is, normally your arteries are not hard. They are pliant. So they, when you send a pulse of blood through the arteries, they give. So you can imagine that every time they're elastic, basically. If you damage them and you calcify them, there's no give. So if anything, that makes your blood pressure get even higher because there's nothing
causing a bit of a blockage. And
Well, that's another thing that can happen, but there's nothing to absorb the pulse of energy anymore because it doesn't give. There's no elasticity. So hardening of the arteries can occur. And as you say, ultimately, if that calcification keeps building up, it will block the arteries. And in fact, if you start blocking very fine arteries like those to the heart muscle, that's when you get a heart attack because you block your coronary arteries and you get what we call a myocardial infarction, which is where you cut the blood supply off to the muscle, to the heart.
So we don't want that. We need to do something about it.
I haven't mentioned strokes either, and they're another problem from...
We talk about that now.
Pressure, yes. So if you... It's another... clot. You can have strokes either by bleeds or by clots. And both can happen actually indirectly as a consequence of high blood pressure. So you're actually, in the similar manner to the way you've blocked off the blood supply to the muscle of the heart, you can block off the blood supply to a patch of brain. And then that's what causes a stroke and loss of function. So all of these things are things we're trying to prevent.
Okay, so what on earth can we do?
Okay, so the first thing we do is we do try and look to see whether there is an underlying cause. And the kind of clues to that are in someone that's under the age of 40, someone that presents with a really high, high, high blood pressure, and or there might be a clue in the history that they tell you that there is an underlying cause. And if we are suspecting that, and that's only 10% of all causes of high blood pressure, if that really, we would refer them for some investigations to look and see where the cause of this is. And there are some known causes, without getting too technical, a lot of them are around the kidney. So you can have a narrowing to the artery that supplies the kidney, for example, that can cause this. You can have a problem with the adrenal gland, which produces various hormones that sits on top of the kidney that can cause this. You can have a narrowing to the aorta, which is one of the main blood supplies. So they're all rare things, but they are all things you can look for.
So it's only about 10% of people who have something in their body which is causing
the
blood pressure.
Yes.
So the other 90%, what's causing their blood
pressure? We call essential hypertension, which means we don't really know why this started. Maybe they're a bit overweight. Maybe they are a smoker. These things all can contribute to high blood pressure.
So smoking, overweight
and generally unfitness.
Okay.
And then this general hardening of the arteries that happens with age. So right. age is a factor because you don't get that give in the arteries anymore. So all of those things can contribute to sort of general high blood pressure.
Right.
It's really important to identify the young people with this accelerated high blood pressure from an underlying cause, though, because they are going to get their heart attacks much earlier, as you can imagine. So if we're diagnosing them when they're 30, you know, if you don't diagnose and you miss it, they might be having their first attack when they're 40, 45.
But it's interesting, Nikki, you know, I'm in my 50s and I mean, we don't generally have sort of regular blood pressure checks, do we?
So everybody that's registered with a GP, we get a code triggering us to request a blood pressure measurement every 5 years.
Oh, okay.
So we will generally, I mean, obviously, if you don't ever go to the doctor, you might not get that trigger.
Mm.
And I think if that is the case, and our listeners might be really healthy and think, well, I've never done that before in my life. It may be worth, you can go to your local chemist and get a blood pressure measurement. Some GP surgeries have a blood pressure measurement device in the lobby. We have one there. And so we would recommend that you get your blood pressure measured every 5 years. If it's abnormal, we would then obviously get you in, do a few more measurements. If you end up on medication, which we'll talk about later, we would then monitor your blood pressure annually, probably.
Right. So, okay.
Yeah.
And obviously, as a woman, you know, if you have children, your blood pressure is then taken, isn't it?
Interestingly, there is a form of high blood pressure during pregnancy, which you may have heard of, called preeclampsia.
Mm.
It's a more complicated mechanism than just high blood pressure. In fact, in pregnancy, it involves protein in the urine and it can affect the baby. It can possibly cause a premature birth, or we might have to induce the baby because of high blood pressure. So again, in pregnancy, your blood pressure is measured a lot, along with urine, just to make sure you haven't got this condition called preeclampsia. If you do develop it, then you would be sort of intensively monitored to make sure the baby's okay, and possibly delivered early if it's something that's not controlled.
So medication, obviously you're encouraging people to change lifestyle habits.
Yes.
Clearly that would be very important. Very important.
Yes.
Do some people not change their lifestyle habits?
It can be really difficult. We all know how hard it is to lose weight, for example. Mm. And you can know that that's the best thing for you and still find that very difficult to do. So I think, you know, we advising people so they have that choice and making sure that they know what would be good for them.
And what the consequences are if they don't do it. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So yes, you mentioned medication. There are, again, nice guidelines for this as to which order we try these in. And I always tell patients there's A, B, C and D, although that is a bit simplified because there are more tablets than that. But A stands for ACE inhibitor. ACE inhibitors work at the kidney and they block, they're called ACE, A-C-E, standing for angiotensin converting enzyme. Mm. So that's very complicated, but that's why they're called that. And they work at the kidney basically and block an enzyme that's involved in making blood vessels smaller. So by indirectly dilating blood vessels, blood pressure will lower. So that's how they kind of work. And so they work at the kidney. They're not good for everybody to take. So you need to talk about that to your GP. Not everybody should be getting them. Mm. But most people would get that first line. That's probably the first thing we try.
And would you try that just for a limited period of time, or can you take that forever?
So the first thing to say about them is that you can take them forever in theory. We would monitor your kidney blood test on them. Some people do get a side effect. The commonest one is cough. It can cause a dry cough, and that's just from the medication. And we do have a different kind of ACE inhibitor that blocks a slightly different version of the enzyme that basically does not give you a cough. So if you do get a persistent cough that's dry on ACE inhibitors, we can switch you to a slightly different version. The other thing they can cause sometimes is, especially if you're a bit more elderly, is they can make your blood pressure drop when you stand up and make you feel dizzy. And that's called postural hypotension, is where your blood pressure drops when you stand up. And if that happens, again, we can either get you to take the dose at bedtime when you're lying down, or we might lower the dose, or we might just give you something different. And the other thing is that people of Black or Afro-Caribbean origin, the guidance is to start a different tablet first. The ACE inhibitors don't work so well.
Okay, so that's the A. The B?
So B is beta blocker. And this isn't necessarily the order we would give them to you in. In fact, beta blockers probably a bit further down the line. But beta blockers, technically, they go against, they counter the fight and flight response, which means they block anxiety associated with that. Again, there are some disadvantages to them. They can give you bad dreams. That's one that can happen. All anti-blood pressure drugs can cause problems with impotence. And so that's something that we tend to ask the men if they're having a problem with. We can obviously adjust the dose or change the medication or lower it. And blood pressure tablets, beta blockers in particular, they do also slow the pulse down. So in very young people, it can make you feel, you know, sometimes they're not the best tablet for those people.
Okay.
So C is calcium channel blocker. They are the first line treatment, usually for Black and Afro-Caribbean people, because they work better for them. The disadvantage of them is that they can cause ankle swelling, and that seems to be dose dependent. So we look out for that, warn people, and if it's a problem, we can lower the dose or change you to a different tablet. You can use the A, B, C or D together or on their own. Each tablet dose seems to lower blood pressure by about 5. So if your blood pressure is 30 above the limit, you're probably going to need either, you know, 5 doses of a tablet or more than one tablet to control your blood pressure. So
just to give me an indication, or our listeners an indication, how, to what extent, I mean, if you lost a stone or something, what would you imagine, how much would you imagine that would lower your blood pressure?
Yes, so, and that would normally lower your blood pressure. Probably, I mean, this is just a rough guess, for each half a stone, you probably lose about 5.
Gosh.
So it's equivalent to a dose of a tablet.
Yeah, yeah.
So, in fact, when you said, do you need the tablets lifelong? The answer to that question really is, if you stay the same with your lifestyle, and the answer is probably yes, you will need them lifelong. If you significantly change your weight or something about you changes,
fitness,
or if you retire from work,
I see,
you know, reduce your stress, then we might be able to stop them or reduce them.
Yeah.
We didn't get to D for diuretic.
No, oh yes.
That's a water pill, works at the kidney. Of course, the disadvantage of that is it does make you wee a lot. People don't always like that. Some people don't notice it though. And there are other add-on blood pressure tablets that we can use if people are intolerant. So that's not the end of all the blood pressure tablets there are in the world. There are more. Sometimes the choice of tablet is determined by what else is going on in your life. Mm. So for example, I'll just use me as an example. I get focal migraines. They're horrible. And beta blockers prevent migraines. So I have high blood pressure, but I use beta blockers because they also prevent my migraines, and they do both. So you might choose a tablet for its dual purpose, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Can we talk a little bit about low blood pressure? Yeah. This is a particular interest to me because I've suffered from low blood pressure for most of my life. So, yeah, it's interesting to hear if that's a problem and how it presents and what we can do about it. How do you define low blood pressure?
Yes, so again, NICE defines low blood pressure as anything below 90 over 60. And actually, when you think about it, that's quite low. People come in with those sort of readings and they're worried. And it just shows you that, you know, we can have a healthy low blood pressure. Athletes tend to have a low blood pressure. The reason it's low, if you're an athlete or you're generally very fit, is that the heart muscle is very effective at pumping. I don't know if I can describe that very well, but what it means is that with each pump of the heart, the blood whooshes around very effectively because the heart's so strong and it's fit because you're an athlete. And so you don't need to have that high blood pressure to get the blood to the places that other hearts can't reach.
It can rush further.
Exactly. So 90 over 60 is defined as hypotension, which means low blood pressure.
Well, I'd like to, you know, I'd like our listeners to imagine me as an amazing athlete, but I'm not. So why might I have low blood pressure?
I mean, I think it would help, Sarah, if you told us what happens when you do get your low blood pressure. How does that make you feel?
Well, what it makes me feel is that if I bend down and stand up again, I feel dizzy. Mm. We've talked about that. Mm. If my blood pressure goes very low, I feel very, very dizzy, even just standing up or sitting. And on a few occasions, it's been so low that I've actually sort of collapsed. Mm. So luckily, that hasn't happened for a long time.
Mm. Did that happen when you were a lot younger, may I ask?
Only about, so it, sort of early 40s.
Yeah, that's quite. I mean, what I would say, Sarah, is you're quite unusual in that this is quite common, but it tends to happen in the teens and early 20s more than in your 40s. But it's not completely unheard of. What I want to say is that there's a sort of natural variant for this. So some people just have a generally low blood pressure. Mm. As I said before, that can be people that are very fit, athletic, or it can be people that are often very young. So, for example, my daughter has also collapsed a few times in her room just from fainting, from just having a very low blood pressure. Mm. And it's not at all unusual in younger people. In those people, we tend to recommend using more salt in your diet, drinking plenty.
Noticed that. If I don't drink enough water, then I tend to feel
worse. Yeah. So definitely that helps. So don't get dehydrated. You can try wearing, this might not be an attractive look, but you can try wearing compression stockings.
Ah.
That might not be something that we should recommend to our very young teenage girls. They're not going to want that.
Okay. But tell me how that works then.
What that does in theory, although I'm not sure if it has a huge effect, but it would have a small effect, is it stops blood pooling in your legs. So therefore, it will help the blood return to the heart and hopefully stop your blood pressure dropping. It's, you know, I always think when there are a lot of solutions to a problem like this list for low blood pressure, there's not one single brilliant answer. All of these help a little bit. Of course, as a GP, the first thing I would consider is whether you're on a blood pressure medication making your blood pressure too low.
Ah.
For us, that's probably the most common thing. It's not for you, because I know you're not on any, but for a lot of our patients, it's just we've got
the
dose too high. And then avoiding alcohol and hot environments can help, because alcohol is a vasodilator. So what that means is it makes you flush. And if you're flushed, your blood pressure drops.
More wine.
And what?
Wine at hot places. Oh, dear.
Avoid standing for long periods. That's the same thing about blood pooling in your legs. And just get up slowly to avoid feeling dizzy. So those are kind of all the advice we would give. There are pathological causes of low blood pressure, though, which means that things that we have to sort of think about treating. And those are, so these are for what I call chronic low blood pressure, which means long-term low blood pressure.
Right.
We'll talk separately about the causes of acute low blood pressure, which means it's suddenly happened, but you're normally okay.
I see.
So chronic low blood pressure, there's something called, this is rare, but it's called Addison's disease. And it's a lack of the hormones produced by the adrenal gland. And it usually is, for some reason, it's usually autoimmune, actually. The adrenal gland, which is a gland that sits on top of the kidney, has been destroyed and the hormones it produces are no longer being produced. It's rare, so around 5 per million people have it. So as you can imagine, we don't see it very often. And it can occur at any age, but commonly between the ages of 30 and 50, and more in women than in men. And it usually is autoimmune. In some countries, TB causes it, but... So basically, one of the features of this, without going into the whole details of a rare disease, is low blood pressure.
Okay.
Particularly the standing up and your blood pressure dropping.
Mm.
We do see abnormalities on the blood tests as well for that disease. But I suspect if we saw someone like you, that would be something that we would discuss and maybe do your blood test and make sure that there's nothing else going on that's strange about it. So the other big kind of cause of low blood pressure that we need to consider as an abnormal thing is something called POTS syndrome. Have you heard of
POTS? No, I've never heard of POTS, no.
So POTS stands for postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. And basically it is defined as an increase in the heart rate by more than 30 beats per minute, or an increase in the heart rate to greater than 120 beats per minute within 10 minutes when moving from lying down to upright. But it also causes a low blood pressure on the whole, and people feel dizzy and lightheaded. But the development of the fast heart rate, which is relieved by lying down, is the most kind of diagnostic feature. People can sometimes pass out with it, and you can get kind of sweating, palpitations, nausea, and it seems to be related to a reduced cerebral blood flow, so blood flow through the brain. When they're upright, some people increase their respiration, so they breathe faster. We're not entirely sure what causes it.
I don't think for my sort of low blood pressure, there are tablets to raise your blood pressure, are there?
So there is, it's just that they are, so the ones that we can use are something called fludrocortisone, which you can use to increase blood pressure, actually.
Oh, okay.
But it really depends how much it's affecting you as to whether you want to take a tablet for something like this. Obviously, if it's, you know, if you're passing out every day and every time you stand up, your heart beats really quickly and it makes you feel really unwell, then we need to do something about that. In most people with low blood pressure, it's not something that's happening all the time. And so if it's something you can live with, obviously we'd rather not give you a tablet for something that's not happening and or not significantly impacting your life.
Or in my case, change your lifestyle. Make sure that you eat more salt.
Drink plenty. Yeah.
Water.
Yeah. And the compression stockings, if you're having to go through a period where it's really not great, reduce alcohol and try and avoid getting too hot and sweaty, because that's going to vasodilate. The other thing you can get is acute hypotension, where you get very unwell.
And hypotension.
Hypo is low.
Low.
Hyper is high. Mm. Yeah, it's very similar.
Yeah.
And that usually happens when somebody's very unwell. So we've had a podcast on sepsis. Mm. And one of the sort of ways you can see septic shock, for example, is if your blood pressure plummets. Similarly, if you have a hemorrhage or lose a lot of blood, your blood pressure can drop suddenly.
You hear it on these medical programs, don't you? They're having a hypo or something.
Oh, that's a different thing. So hypo in that context means your sugar levels dropped usually, whereas this is your blood pressure dropping.
Right.
But if that happens and you're, obviously if someone's acutely unwell, they'd have to go to A&E and get sorted out. You can also see it with heart arrhythmias. If the heart pauses and your blood pressure drops, then you might conk out, for example. But if you're normally well, that would be unusual, and we'd have to have a look and see what was going on with that.
Mm. Is there anything else that we need to discuss with blood pressure?
I was going to just mention for POTS that there is a charity called POTSUK.org, and there is another one called STARS.org. So if people want to get more information about POTS syndrome, that might be a good place to do it. Mm. There are other medications for POTS that you can consider under a specialist supervision. I think that that's the main thing. I think it's worth getting medication if you have got high blood pressure, just to prevent the long-term consequences, even if you feel normal. Yeah. It can seem irritating, I think, to take tablets when you don't feel that you need them. But unfortunately, it's a bit of a silent killer, mm-hmm. high blood pressure.
Remember the Cress analogy.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this month's podcast. Don't forget that if this has made you aware of troubling medical symptoms, you may need to see your GP.
This has been an I Am Listening exclusive podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.